Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am thrilled to invite you to Rachel Uncensored, my podcast where I get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. From personal stories to hot button issues, we cover it all. New episodes drop every Wednesday, so make sure you tune in on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.
Hello and welcome to the IGN UK podcast. We've changed our theme tune this week, and I'll get to that in a second, but I'm joined by the lovely Daniel Krupa.
Hey, everyone.
And Mr. Kieran Gillen, which is the reason we have changed our theme tune this week. We've changed it to Summer Camp's Pink Summer. Now, that's quite a special song for you, which we'll sort of get to later. But maybe, you know, for the people who don't know who you are, if you want to sort of introduce yourself in a better way than I probably can.
I just feel very honoured that the theme tune has changed to Pink Summer, which
is the first time I've ever changed the theme tune, maybe?
Yeah, you've broken with 265 episodes of tradition there. So.
Did
you clear this?
I really didn't, actually.
Yes, we're destroying society. I've walked into a room and already actually destroyed a culture, which is kind of what I do. My name is Kieran Gillen. I'm primarily a writer. I also a dancer.
Yeah.
Not a lover, sadly.
I've seen you dance. You're a great dancer.
Didn't know what you were going to say then.
You don't get to correct the lover part. No, I write comics now. I used to be a games critic, so I used to write for load of magazines and places like that. I moved into comics somehow, and I basically write books for Marvel. As in, I've written stuff like Uncanny X-Men and Iron Man and Journey into Mystery and Young Avengers, and I could go on and on. And I do my own books for like Phonogram, which was my first book, and Wiccan Divine, which is my current book, and books like Uber and Mercury Heat that's coming out. And I could really ramble on, but I write a lot of comics.
Yeah, that is what we're going to do. Yeah.
That's a big part of today's podcast.
Yeah. It is indeed, so we usually start sort of our podcast with, what have you been playing, watching, or reading of interest lately? Anything? You don't have to say
What I have? Tell you what, last year's weird, because that's a guy who was obsessed by games forever.
Yeah.
2014 was pretty fallow. I barely played anything in the mainstream at all. I did no more than 5 hours in any AAA game, which is literally unheard of since 97 was the last time I had a year with that fallow of gaming.
Yeah.
Was there a particular reason for that? Or just work overtaking?
I think my heart just wasn't in it. Yeah. It was the year before was really bad, and I kind of was, my energies were elsewhere. And I was playing some board game stuff, but since the new year, things have picked up, which is quite exciting because, you know, my wife bought a PS4 when I was away on a business trip and returned to find the PS4 in the front room. I was kind of upset being a PC Master Race kind of guy.
What's this?
What the hell is this box? So I threw it through the window and stomped around, but eventually I was seduced to playing some games. So we've basically been playing Diablo 3 co-op.
Oh, cool.
So it's me and my wife have been sitting on the sofa, and bashing the living hell out of boxes and collecting it. So it's kind of involves killing and shopping.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like this weird, I always think Sex and the City could basically be translated to Diablo 3.
Yeah.
In that it's about getting increasingly fancy loot and then wearing it and killing more things. Not as much killing. Swap sex for killing and you basically got it. But yeah, that's been good. I had I had some friends over on Saturday, two couples of me and my wife's.
Yeah.
And we played 11 hours of board game stuff, six different games. We played an entire array of, what was it?
In order.
We played The Resistance. We started that. So we started Paranoia and Hatred. the middle Dixit, so a bit of like French whimsicality.
I do love Dixit. Those cards are just incredible.
Yeah, they are incredible. It's like, if you haven't seen Dixit, there's basically a game where you have to try to work out what these cards could mean, and it's all basically a load of like Freudian dream imagery.
Yeah,
it's you look at them and it's my wife.
You'll love it.
Unpacking dream symbolism.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, the game basically works like you have to it's almost like whimsical French adventure game version of like Cards Against Humanity.
Yeah.
In this kind of, you basically have to pick a card and say a word like, though, the feeling of sadness, and you put your card down face down, and everyone else has to pick their card they think means the feeling of sadness.
Okay. Yeah.
Then everyone has to guess which one was yours. So it's about how you think and how you describe, and it's a really kind of soft game, which is nice.
It is really good. Like, because I've played it so much, I've managed to find a way to game it in a sense which sort of spoils it for some people who've played with me before, because if I'm playing with new people, you can just do it. It's like playing poker. You can pick up a card in a certain way, or I can look a certain way at a card, or spend so much time on a card because you're allowed to pick them up and look at them and stuff like that. And I find it really easy to influence other people's decisions. So then I'm basically Darren Brown. But I find it easy. And my ex-girlfriend refused to play with me.
Oh, wow.
And it's such a lovely game. To have someone refuse to play with you probably says a lot about me.
I mean, the traditional way,
really sad way to end that digression, just like, my ex-girlfriend didn't want to play with me.
Yeah.
It is a strange, because it's not really that. Because winning doesn't really matter in any way. Yeah. It's called those games.
So what's it called, sorry?
Dixit. D-I-X-I-T.
What's the meaning of that?
Don't know.
I forget. My wife. It's Latin. I forget what it means.
Okay.
Sorry, someone spoke Latin. Told me what it meant. I forgot it.
Yeah, that's good.
And then Illuminati, and that was, and they played that card flappy game. Yeah. And I literally forget what that's called. Double. We played Double. Illuminati, retro conspiracy game. We did play Cards Against Humanity. Yeah. And there was one more game. It was a day of so much gaming, I forgot it. Oh, and I played my first Warhammer Fantasy Battle game since...
Oh, amazing.
'94.
Okay. Wow.
Which was an amusing thing to do.
Is this a Christmas present you had?
It's actually quite lucky. Almost anything I like doing, I can turn into money.
Okay.
And that becomes weird, because if I listen to music, I can turn that into money, or everything becomes work. And I sort of started painting Skaven, which are like the Warhammer Fantasy rat men.
Yeah.
And I started paying them in 2008. I can't pay for toffee, but it's incredibly soothing. This cannot profit me in any way. This will not impress women. No one will love me anymore for doing this. I silently daub these. I stopped looking at the internet. It's incredibly soothing. I feel like that very old man at the bottom of the shed and, painting loud soldiers. It's literally the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm at the point now where I've actually I paid enough for an army. So I talked to a friend, let's have a game. And we've had a game, and it was hilarious. It was literally, everything exploded, and we laughed ourselves sick all the way through it. It was a really great joy.
That's amazing.
Now he's bought a load of undead, so we're going to do another game at some point.
That's excellent.
Yeah, so that was a weirdly life-affirming selection of things which make me realise, not realise, but remember how much I love gaming, because how important it has been to me at different times.
Oh, so definitely.
A good start to the year, basically.
Wow, that is good, as well. I'm obsessed with a board game at the moment called The Sheriff of Nottingham.
What's that like?
That's the one you bought recently, isn't it?
Oh, so good, yeah. It's so basically, I don't even think, there's sort of a board to it, but basically you're a store owner. The sheriff comes round to the store. Everyone takes it in turn to be sheriff. And it's kind of like cheats, the card game cheat, where you have these little pouches, and you can try and get... You have to basically make the most money by lying about what's in your pouch or telling the truth. So you've got your sort of bread, chicken, apples and something else, and cheese. But you've also got contraband. I think one of them's an axe and things like that. And you can sort of... But it's all about lying to the sheriff and convincing him not to open your bag. Or if he opens it... And you're actually not telling the truth. You are actually telling the truth. You get loads of money as well. I'm not explaining it very well. It is really good.
That sounds good. You've actually made me remember what the sixth game was, which was Masquerade.
Okay, cool.
Which is kind of like Love Letter, if you know that.
Love Letter's amazing.
It's another game of bluff and lying and trying to work out. It's basically each card allows you to do a certain thing, but you never know which card you have.
Yeah.
And you swap between them, and it becomes very confusing, and you're basically bluffing on not knowing what your card is.
Yeah.
So you say, I'm definitely the king.
Yeah.
And they go on the table and someone calls you or not. So it's a very quick game of complete confusion and lying.
Excellent.
But yeah, I'm a big fan of that one as well.
It's really good. Like, I didn't really explain Sheriff of Nottingham very well. It is really good.
It's weird. I said, playing all these board games, because I'm friends with Quentin Smith.
Yeah.
Shut Him and Sit Down, which is an amazing website.
Yeah.
But saw that and also Rab Florence, and seeing him go into into board games pretty much the same time I was, how much I've discovered certain things about myself, and as in I'm quite bad at telling when certain people are lying to me.
Okay.
As in, like,
Like your wife or like friends?
Generally speaking, I trust women more than men.
Okay.
Okay.
And that's an interesting, and I've realized across almost all board games.
Yeah.
I intrinsically distrust men and have like a basic fondness for women.
So all female listeners,
yeah,
basically your fair game to be deep.
I look back at my life and realise, wait, I need to rethink everything. As in, I really have in a semi way. It's yeah. like when my mum like was playing Resistance one Christmas, like last year. Sorry, the Christmas before last.
Yeah.
And she completely lied a perfect game. And yeah. I was looking at her and then the scales fell from my eyes and I realised how powerful my mum was. Yeah. So don't trust my mum is what I'm saying. No yeah, one trusts my mum.
See, I can't play Werewolf with anyone. Have you ever played Werewolf?
No.
Like, you'd love that as well. Because I can't. And basically, it's not a board game. It's just a sort of parlor game where it's kind of like, I guess, Wink Murder or Mafia. There's other games like
yeah.
that. Where one of you, two of you are the werewolves and you have to all go to sleep. People die. Then you have to sort of, all the villagers have to decide who they're going to hang. And I can't play that because it's all about lying. It's all about convincing people. So if I'm, and obviously I'm...
The hairiest man in the room.
Also, yeah, one, I look like a werewolf.
Who's
yeah.
the werewolf?
But like, because I'm so mouthy, if I'm quiet, people yeah. suspect me straight away. If I'm just myself, people go, well, he's blatantly the werewolf, because look how like chops he's being, everyone else is being really quiet. So
I literally
can't play that game. Yeah.
I'm so into Resistance, people distrust me in Resistance.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I'm not trustworthy.
Well, that's really good. So yeah, so you're saying then, so you've moved away almost from video games to just be board games, but you know,
2015 might be a year of your drum.
I've literally forgotten the name of the game. It was RPS's Game of the Year.
Okay.
Eternal, the Civ clone, involving Fantasy Civ clone.
I don't know.
Rock Paper Shotgun's Game of the Year. I've literally Eternal Legend.
Yeah, okay.
I've been playing.
If you didn't remember that, then you're going to absolute murder.
Yeah, so I still like one of the, I'm on Rock Paper Shotgun on the website. I still kind of involved in them.
Yeah,
You're a co-founder.
I am the co-founder. Yeah. I'm actually literally a suit. So I've okay. no suit at the website. I'm literally a publisher, which is terrible. Yeah. As in, I've kind of
amazing
ascended to a lower level. but yeah, I was playing that and I quite like it. It hasn't quite clicked for me because there's something. What's the word? I just don't think it's as weird as everyone else. I was expecting it to be weirder, and it's quite uninspiring.
Okay,
yeah. As in, it's clearly got a lot of quality there, but I'm not like immediately in love with it.
Okay,
but you know, I will try to persist with it.
Yeah, but obviously, so you started out, you know, as a games critic, and you know, a lot of people will almost credit you for being one of the first real games critics, I guess.
Kotaku once said, "Some might say he invented games journalism," which just literally makes me laugh myself sick.
<He's> like, so I got a tattoo of that.
Like, if I had a book, I'd put it on the back, obviously. Yeah. But it's like, I don't think
no matter what the book is about. Exactly.
I invented all of this.
All this is mine, and I own this thing. Mm. No, that's lewd. I mean, it's like there's really, I mean, I started writing about games in 94. That's when I was at university, and I basically paid my way for my second year at university writing for Amiga Power.
Okay.
But you know, I was a games press obsessive. I can still quote Stuart Campbell and Jonathan Nash reviews. Yeah. I can quote a Duncan MacDonald review from 87, I think. That's Stunt Car Racer, an entire opening about being as happy as a sandboy. So I really was kind of like into the games press. I'm somebody who's always really enjoyed games writing in a way that is somewhat obsessional.
Yeah.
So, but you know, I came from that background. I was basically somebody who loved both music writing, which has always been more pretentious, and games
definitely,
writing.
Yeah.
And so I kind of like put that all together, and that's what I kind of did.
Yeah. So basically found a way to make games writing as pretentious as music writing.
At times, but also like, you know, I did more knob gags than most people. You know, as in it was a weird kind of mix.
That's sort of expected, isn't it?
It is. It's just flowery knob gags. Yeah.
It's like I basically ripped off everybody I loved, and that's kind of what I've always done as a writer. As in that kind of my influence is quite obvious.
But you had those influences then, sorry.
Oh, I mean, like in games press, it's like I was a genuinely an almost Amiga Power fanboy, and it's like being able to write for them in the last 12 issues is kind of like being in the Beatles.
Yeah.
I mean, I played Triangle in the Beatles. That wasn't anything important, but I got to, you know, I was on the credits.
Yeah.
And that was, in retrospect, I was a religiously fanatical member, IEP fan. It was a bit worrying, to be honest. So, I mean, Jay Nash, Stuart Campbell, I will always love Cam for hiring me. The music press, especially the guys of the period, like Simon Reynolds, who's an amazingly precise music journalist and very academic. I always admired him because he was someone I couldn't write like him. I could never quite do that. But, like, of my journey, like, Neil Kulkarni, Taylor Parks from the Melody Maker at the time, Simon Price, those are kind of, like, quite important people to me. And I dug back, you know, I've read my Lester Bangs, I've read... my Nick Kent and my Paul Morley. I'm a big Paul Morley fan. Paul Morley's Words and Music is kind of the big influence on Phonogram, which is a comic about pop music.
Yeah.
And it kind of like metaphorical pop music folded into this kind of weird structure. So yeah, all that really, I guess.
And then how does the sort of Rock, Paper, Shock and stuff come about then? Did you guys, I mean, it's obviously just spotting a gap in the market, I guess, is it?
It was one of those weird, like, this is something I often say about RPS, in that people get into the idea of doing what you think is right is automatically anti-commercial.
Mm.
And that is a defeatist attitude. It's the kind of the idea that it means that if your band only sells any copies of records, it can't be any good.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like a defeatist narrative that's sold to us by people who frankly want to keep you on your knees. I mean, I've been making jokes so far and you've suddenly got me, you can hear the segue into angry man who writes manifestos about games.
Right, everyone brace yourself, we're changing gear.
Right, hold it to time. But it's like kind of, you know, there's a lot of narratives that the world tries to sell you, which are frankly will only hurt you if you believe it.
Mm.
With RPS, it was a case of like there was no good PC games website, and that's not really an easy way to phrase that. But in terms of like doing something that was agile and was able to do the sort of stuff that RPS did in its early years, and still tries to do, there wasn't anyone doing it, and we thought, well, Paradox has ads money. It's a really basic question. That kind of like, if we go get an audience, we thought it would be financially worthwhile.
Yeah.
At the same time, there clearly should be a site.
Yeah.
But then it was formerly Jim's idea, as in Jim Rossignol. He kind of pushed it, and he recruited me and Alec and John. I was living with Jim at the time, and Jim was an old school mate all the way from PC Gamer. And I had just split up with a long term girlfriend, so I was pretty much like sleeping on his sofa. Let's do a website. And it was like, actually, it could work. So I decided to give it 3 years and see how it would go. And when it stayed, I kind of left when the site stabilized, when we started actually being able to pay wages to everyone and everything was fine. But yeah, it was one of those situations where let's do a website because we, in our way, and of course what RPS is good at, it's very good at, and what it's not very good at, it's not very good at. It's kind of like it's a website very clearly run by writers, which means we fall downstairs a lot and we're not, you know, and we get confused by cups of tea and all those kind of things. But you know, the level of freedom there was a lot of fun. It was the idea, it's kind of like, since that was really late in my career, we launched in 2007 as a games writer. And I said, I started writing in 94. I actually presumed I would never get to launch a magazine.
Yeah.
And it took me about a year into RPS to realize, wait, no, this is
exactly what I'm doing. Yeah.
This is that moment. Yeah.
This is it. And it's an astounding legacy. Yeah. And I use that word in that kind of, people not listening won't be able to see my eyes or be confused by this. But you know, how incredibly proud I am of what the guys have achieved. And because we started with a WordPress site in Favors.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not like, a sort of Polygon, which launches with all the money in the world.
Yeah,
huge sponsorship.
Exactly. Yeah. We launched with, like, we're going to do, we, you know, you can tell we put the work in, because you basically all our wages cut by a third with other freelance.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we just, you know, we made that investment and we just did it.
Yeah.
And we cashed in all our favours.
Yeah.
And it worked, which is very lucky. And the thing is, like, we've seen a lot of people try to do other websites and they haven't worked for different reasons.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of it's being lucky. We just never underestimate being lucky. But a specific time, a specific place.
Yeah.
I mean, like the timing, the sort of gaming we believed in was kind of coming more into focus.
Yeah.
Because you think of 2007, that's the start of that period of the indie boom. So we kind of believe that PC gaming, quote unquote, it should be wider.
Yeah.
We kind of quite deliberately said, we redefined PC gaming to be anything on a PC, anything on a keyboard, and we defined PCs to include like spectrums.
Yeah.
And the idea of here is an, instead of a PC being a format, a PC is an ideology. An ideology by definition is very open. And we define ourselves against console and any form of closed gaming. Not because we didn't like console gaming, because we do. but we kind of
demarcate a space.
Yeah.
And we're aware that there's so, gaming is so big. It was big then, it's bigger now.
Yeah.
There was space to just concentrate on part of it and cover it as much as we could inside there.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to like, even the very big sites which have enormous resources, such as IGN, aren't covering everything.
Yeah.
And the idea
going back to board games, there was a discussion since my time being here where we talked about, you know, should we launch a channel called IGN Analog or something in board games and tackle it? It's like, is that too far straying from our remit? Which probably is. And other sites, like you mentioned, do it better than we would ever be able to do it.
Yeah.
So again, it's knowing what you do and doing it well.
Yeah.
So that was your ability,
And we were kind of like, we want to be a site. We were quite an optimistic site to begin with. We've kind of become more cynical now.
Yeah.
But the idea that, you know, we were kind of, we're quite pro pushing that idea of like gaming is worthwhile and this is an interesting way to spend our time.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was fun. It was fun and awful at the same time.
Yeah.
I actually made a board game about running a games blog. I've got a prototype. It's like it's an operative prototype.
You need to bring that in and we need to play that, definitely.
You will laugh yourself sick. It's a semi-cooperative board game about...
That describes our team.
Exactly. It's you get stories, you decide who's going to write the story, and basically you have to hit traffic targets. And if you fail to hit a traffic target, everyone's sacked.
I want
to
play this.
You are playing this.
With your own life.
You don't know the consequences. You haven't been fully briefed yet. You don't know what the end game is.
Yeah. But only one person can win. And you win individually by gaining prestige points.
Well, I'm not going to win that.
And that's like, so you have to argue, okay, I'm not going to write that story, the top 10 girls in games. I lose prestige. Yeah. But we need the traffic somewhat, and so you make the
deal. So we take it.
No, no, it's been sitting around, and one day I'll get around to finishing it, but it's a giggle.
I'm interested to see it. So, I mean...
I swear, the audience of that game is literally the people in this room.
Yeah.
Let's kickstart that. I'll buy a copy. Anyone listening to that, let's kickstart that. I'm interested, though. So, you were at PC Gaming when you guys launched... or decided to launch Rock Paper Shotgun, is that right? Or
no, I left PC Gaming in 2003. We were all freelancers.
Right, okay, cool.
We launched in 2000. So I was like freelancers for getting on for 5 years before we launched RPS.
Right, okay.
We still quite often did freelance for PC Gamer.
Of course,
We worked for Eurogamer. I'd work for pretty much everybody.
Yeah.
I found myself walking in today, I don't think I've ever worked for IGN, which is weird. I've literally, you know, from The Guardian to Wired.
We're not paying you for this.
If you want a credit, it's fine.
Give me a review quickly.
I'm just sort of interested to see, like, what was there a, you know, with what you wanted to do with Rock Paper Shotgun, was there no, you know, possible way that obviously you know huge ties to PC Gamer and things, who at the time I don't think had a site, or the site wasn't, you know, I'm just curious what was there about PC Gamer that you thought there's no way that we could actually do what we wanted to do with them?
Well, we like to own it. I mean, it's like in a very, this is kind of, you're talking about the PC ideology.
Yeah.
It's the idea that we can do it and therefore we shall.
Mm.
I mean, you know, we had no desire to work inside a larger organisation. I mean, I'm temperamentally unsuited to doing it because I keep on saying things like this. You know, I have a tendency to have a mouth and opinion and kind of live with it.
Mm.
That sounds self-aggrandizing. I don't mean it in that way.
I
highly enjoyed spending 5 years at Future, and I left because I was burnt out. And then I kind of ambled along freelance, and that's when I started writing comics. And by I got to this point, I was more up for doing something in a more organised fashion. We just, I think, we saw the hole and we were aware that Future weren't about to do it. I mean, we didn't seem to have been trying to push for us. I mean, there was a PC web gamer website at present at the time, but they weren't quite like together in the same way, I think. And the chance to actually own it was worthwhile. And it's like kind of like, if it works, this is useful.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
No,
and it's like one of the things that, I don't even want to say that. It's like, at working PC Gamer, I became aware of how much money PC Gamer made.
Yeah.
And I don't say this in a bad way, and I was also aware of how little I was getting paid. and that's capitalism. And I became aware of,
well, no, that should be my money.
And I was like, well, there's certainly, if we owned the means of production, we would own, you know, that. So that is, that's what I mean. It's like, it was ideologically the right thing to do, but it was also a financially sensible business model. You know, I could then explain why I thought this site would work with a cold head as well as my hot head. And that's kind of the idea that both aren't contradictory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's talking about, I hate talking about the money in that way.
I don't get paid for this podcast.
Yeah. Well, no, he's not, so don't tell him. So that's interesting. So around then you started writing comics, and I'd love to hear how you decided to start that and where that took you.
Were you always a comics fan as a kid? Or like, because,
It's a weird one. That's that no sign of disbelief. As an actual real kid, in like, you know, a preteen, I read like all the stuff on the newsagent shelves and that kind of like that, especially my age, which was a very casual thing to do.
Yeah.
And I kind of fell out of comics in the teens because I'm from Stafford and I don't believe it had a comic shop then.
Mm.
So even if I was wanted to go into comics, I couldn't. But, you know, I was, especially because I read the music press, I read the games press, especially at that time, there was kind of a soft discussion of it, as in the idea that they talked about Watchmen, they talked about Dark Knight Returns.
It was in the air.
In your Sinclair at the time, there was an awareness of this is part of culture.
Hmm.
So I knew about stuff, and I was like, that sounds interesting.
I'd love to read that.
There's no access to it.
Yeah.
So in my 20s, I picked up Watchmen when I was 21, and that was kind of like my headshot moment.
Yeah.
And that kind of changed me fundamentally. But it was took me until I was 25. I was like about my 2.5 years into PC Gamer. I just started going to comic shops more often because there's one in Bath, which is where Future's based. And one day I just hit a book called The Authority by Warren Ellis, and I kind of fell in. And it's and that moved me very quickly. Next week I discovered Planetary. Next week I discovered Transmet. The week after that I was on the Warren Ellis forum, which was a very, very big thing in like circa 2000. In fact, a lot of the quite like larger names of creators circa now kind of came from there. You're talking about like Matt Fraction.
That's
and
amazing.
Me came with Kelly Sue, and it was almost like a revolutionary sell. It feels, I'm sorry, I was saying this very weird about the how successful Image is right now. Feels like the WEF winning. This is kind of what our idea is what comics should be. Transplanted forward 15 years, which is very strange. But I sort of, and then Warren Ellis forum was acted as my education. I basically learned so much about comics because people talked about stuff, and it was very Catholic education. It was like, you know, manga and French comics and American comics, and it was all kind of viewed as a kind of, this is the medium. So I fell in love in that kind of way. I went to my first con 6 months after that, came home drunk from that con, wrote my first strip, and like the next year I had my first like webcomic out, and the year after that I took a collection of these webcomics to the con, was selling them. A guy called Jamie McKelvey walked up, showed me his portfolio, and I said, we should do a book called Phonogram. And then 4 years after that, Phonogram's out. So it's that kind of, I just basically people say it's like people who are late converts to religion are a lot more fanatical than early converts. I was a late convert. And I'm like, I came in with like all this energy, and I was kind of heading towards being I really did enjoy my time at Future. But at that point, 2.5 years into being there, I was aware that I'd kind of done not everything I could do there, but I was aware that I was like writing about 50 pages a month or something. Like I think my highest for PC Gamer was 37, but I was still doing about 10, 12, 13 pages of freelance to other people. Plus, page counts were much bigger. Word counts were much bigger then. We're like, in fact, there was like 800 words a page. So, but I was like, that was like, if you actually read PC Gamer that period, like 1998 to like 2000, you're pretty much reading my diary. And like, you can map it. I'm like, there's a running joke, like, Eurogamer readers mock it. In that kind of, it's a Kieran Gillen stealth girlfriend review. when I'm really sort of mentioning, this girl I was seeing, it was very complicated. And I was like, it was really just all the creative ideas I had went to that magazine. And at that point, I realized why I'm actually doing this. And that's kind of, I started working less hard on the magazine. As in, to that, not to the level of complete psychosis. And started doing
siphoning something off.
And doing my own. And from that point onwards, I basically, my day job was a video game journalist, and my night job was I worked on comics. And eventually, people started paying me for the comics. Like I said, 2006 was Phonogram, and then I started getting work for higher stuff. Like the year after that, like 2007, 2008, and when people started paying me, I started doing it during the day because I could work out meat by doing this. And about the time 2009, I realised I'm no, you know, despite thinking I am a games journalist who occasionally does comics, I looked at the money I was making. I'm a comic writer who occasionally does games journalism. I started thinking myself in that way. And in 2010, I kind of explicitly did a kind of, it is over now. I am now not doing any more games journalism, except when I cannot help myself.
How did you adapt to writing comics, and how do you approach writing a comic? Do you write very detailed descriptions? Do you direct the art, or do you write a very loose kind of
set of notes
hand over?
In fact, I mean, there's two traditional ways of writing comics, and which is Marvel method, and I apologise if I'm being boring to anybody who knows this, and the full script. Marvel method is the short way of describing it was pretty much invented by Marvel in the 60s, and the idea is you basically, the writer writes a story almost, occasionally broken up into pages, as in this happens on this page one, but occasionally not, and then the artist adapts the story, and then the writer comes in afterwards and adds the dialogue. And that's got various strengths. There's a kind of symbiotic energy, and the artist has a lot more freedom. Its weaknesses, it would include, it really is putting a lot of faith in the artist. If it goes wrong, it goes amazingly wrong.
It's really good when you have Jack Kirby.
If I could actually resurrect Jack Kirby, it might work. I've done some stuff in Marvel method, it's worth stressing, but it's kind of, it does put so much faith in the artist. And in terms of I learned to write from reading a few Warren Ellis columns. That was my starting place. And it's what's right. So you may be thinking these pages have to be you know, a talking heads, like a serious conversation where you explain the plot, and the artist made you think, I really want to have a draw picture of a dinosaur.
Yeah.
And then you come back and you realise you've got a page of dinosaur. I've got to put some dialogue on the dinosaur.
Yeah.
And I've had some dialoguing dinosaur moments, because that's and that's part of the fun of the medium. They kind of, oh my god, what the hell am I going to do? Full script is the other way of doing it, and the way I primarily works, and it's basically, it's like the world's most anal screenplay in terms of page one, panel one, medium shot on of three men talking about comics in the IGN room. The men look like this, descriptions, dialogue, Kieran, colon. Yeah. I'm going to tell you about comics. Panel two, close on Kieran, waving his hands around like an idiot. Comics, this is, you know what I mean?
As yeah, very complicated. Yeah.
That sounds really good, though. Like, but it's like controlling like, that. Yeah. That's amazing.
And the question is you can write that. It's reliable, but the artist... How much will the artist choose to follow it?
Has to submit to it in a way.
Yeah, and I don't want them anything. No, it's a soft back and forth. As in, I ought to start all my scripts. I write heavy scripts. I mean, not heavy like Alan Moore. Alan Moore does about like 20,000 words a script. Yeah. And not light. There's people who write lighter than me. My scripts for like Marvel tend to be about 5,000-6,000 words. My scripts for like creator own projects tend to be a bit longer.
Yeah.
I generally write what I need. And I tend to make myself quite personal. If I know the artist, I write jokes for them, or I talk in a human way. Pretty much all my scripts start with, I write the way I write because I want to make sure there is a way to tell the story. This is not saying you have to tell the story this way. You're an artist, you've got a better visual imagination than I am, by definition. Yeah. That's why you're the artist. Yeah. you know.
Interested, do you ever draw anything? Because I know, I listened to interviews with Jeff Johns and Grant Morrison, and they kind of do rough sketches they hand off to the artist. But again, as kind of suggestions, and
I only sketch when I only sketch when something I am trying to describe is impossible.
Yeah,
that's a good way of putting it. As in, like, there's definitely me and Jamie McKelvey tend to push the form. So occasionally, I get an idea for a sequence, and that it just doesn't translate to words. So I'll do a scribble or like that kind of thing, and then he will get, and Jamie will run with it. It's like. I mean, I normally describe my scripts a bit like love letters.
Okay.
It's about trying to seduce somebody into making them do what you want to do. As in, please fall in love with me.
Yeah.
There is that element to it for me. As in, here is a persuasive argument why I think this is the best way to do it.
Yeah.
But tell me if I'm full of shit. Sorry.
That's fine. Yeah.
So that's kind of, the collaboration is really the interesting part of it for me. The reason why I write full script is because I like comics and I like stories, but specifically I got into comics to write comics.
Yeah.
And if I'm not writing full script and calling individual panels, not necessarily like the details, but if I'm not doing the pacing that level, I don't feel I'm writing comics. Okay. I feel I'm writing a story which someone else adapts to comics.
Yeah.
And that's kind of not something I'm particularly interested in, because if it was, I would get into a different medium.
Yeah.
But that's my particular approach.
Yeah. Do you find yourself like quite lucky then that Jamie walked up when he did?
It's weird. Again, it's like
luck, like you said,
because I put your work together so much. Like, I don't know if you took either one of you out, what it would look like. It's fine, don't worry. I don't know if you took either you out of the equation. It's a completely different thing. It just, I don't know how it would work.
No, it's I think about it quite a bit, and you get these kind of weird stories about bands forming or creators meeting. Yeah.
And he literally just walked up to you.
Yeah. To be fair, you could see us, if you look at our history and our shared social group, you could see these people circling together.
Right.
This is one of my general pieces of advice to like creators when they say, I mean, I get asked quite a bit, how do you get into it? Or how do you think I should get into it? And it's like immersing yourself in fandom and finding the part of fandom which is you. Mm. There's many parts of fandom which I wouldn't, you know, I'm not that guy. You know, I'm not interested in that part of like comics.
Yeah.
But there are people who are, and there's nothing wrong with that. Those people get together. It's only like games, just like, you know, if you were like, you hang out with RTS people, you know, you're going to make an RTS game. You know, people who care about certain things, and that is what scenes.
Yeah.
And we were moving these particles in the scenes, and me and Jamie have an overlapping and often shared aesthetic.
Yeah.
You like to say that it's inevitable to meet. In practice, it's not. Yeah. You're very lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's interesting. So then at what point, obviously, like, Phonogram came out, and at what point then were you approached by Marvel, or were you sending them things, or you were a guy that they approached and came to?
I never went, I mean, I got into comics like the full on in love with comics in 2000, and in 2010 I was writing four, And that's a kind of, if you think about it in any serious way,
it's amazing.
That makes no sense.
Bonkers.
Yeah, it's like
it's gonna be a lot of people listening, going like, "What?"
I know. It's like, it was an intense, you know, when I was learning to write comics, you could sort of tell the comics I was writing because they're very clearly inspired by what I'd read the week before. And I don't mean like characters; I mean like storytelling methods.
Yeah,
it's like when I was reading the week I read Luther Arkwright, I was doing these big 12-panel slow motion scenes, and you know the week I read Cerebus, multi-panel transition across stuff. You can sort of see me
you're like rapidly absorbing stuff,
and that's kind of you absorb your influences and eventually metabolize them into something which is basically you. And that's kind of, that was the same as games writing, that's the same as like any writing really, I think. You've got to allow to be derivative and hopefully get over it. I've lost track of the track.
Segue into Marvel.
I didn't ever really see myself as a Marvel writer.
Yeah.
I mean, I like Marvel comics. I got in like circa 2000, which is like where Joe Quesada was basically
resetting it.
Yeah. But you know, very much changing the beat of Marvel and a very different company. And it's like, this is new X-Men by Grant and Quat Frank. You know, books like I particularly love, like Pete Milligan. Pete Milligan's one of my favorite comic writers, and Allred doing X-Force and those kind of books. And there was like, they had a sensibility that appealed to me, so that's one reason the period I leant towards Marvel.
Yeah,
but I never really saw myself as a guy pitching them, as much as I loved the thing. So I basically had my stuff out there. I sort of semi-pitched a Dazzler story at them because Matt Fraction was writing for them at the time.
Yeah,
and people used to in interviews ask me what Marvel, you know, what superheroes do you want to write.
Yeah,
and of course, this is kind of Comics Press, and God bless Comics Press, I love them. But like, if I'm hyping my dodgy indie book, I'm not very interested in talking about stuff that isn't.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and that's kind of, and also the fact that superheroes dominate the conversation is problematic.
Mm, yeah.
So I, you know, I have a prepared joke answer, and the prepared joke, obviously, I want to write Dazzler. Phonogram being about pop music. So
it fits together quite well,
it gets a laugh.
Yeah.
We move on.
Yeah.
But the problem by making that joke and being a writer, you just part of your brain starts thinking about it.
Well, maybe.
And I end up having this idea. So I've just hammered out this idea for like Dazzler plays a gig on the moon to Celestials. It's basically a prog versus disco story. The entire synopsis was put online. I lobbed it up online last year after Greg Pact urged me to, and actually it went quietly viral in a small way.
Yeah.
So anyone wants to see that, please Google it. It's possibly funny. Black Bolt sings backing vocals at the gig, and it's very stupid.
That's good.
So I lobbed that because they were looking for a Dazzler mini, but it didn't work for lots of reasons. Yeah. Not least it was utterly bonkers. I got in at Marvel. The thing about Phonogram is, obviously people listening probably haven't read it. Phonogram is this kind of like very low level urban fantasy comic about pop music being magic, specifically any music, and I've defined pop music in the widest terms. And it's very critically dense. It involves people sitting around and smoking cigarettes and not really doing much. There's no likable characters, there's no fight scenes. And it reviewed.
And then Marvel came knocking.
Marvel was like, we need more smoking.
People knew it reviewed very well, so it was good. But it doesn't really scream, this guy is definitely the guy to take over a four. Warren Ellis, bless his cotton socks. I don't think he wears cotton socks. He was doing a book called Universal for Marvel. And there was, Marvel wanted to do some tie-ins, like, you know, one-off single issues. And what Warren said, okay, as long as I get to pick the writers. And Warren is an incredible, I was talking about this recently with other people, but Warren is the secret curator of like noughties comic culture. So many people owe Warren so much in terms of like, he's somebody who genuinely cares about the medium and like tries to introduce people and gives so many people so much good advice. There's, you know, I don't even want to list names, but it's kind of like a lot of people owe Warren stuff. And so Warren, for these three things, Warren said, I think Kieran should do one. And if Kieran should do the 1950s James Ellroy kind of one, which is called, it's completely different to Phonogram. So I did that. And I'm pretty sure Marvel like raised their eyebrow a bit, but you know, I did it, and it worked very. You know, people seemed to like it in terms of like, and it went around Marvel. And they went, so I said, "This is people like Phonogram." Where I said, "This guy can actually write superheroes as well."
Yeah.
So this kind of like quite gritty, serious. I shot an alternate dimension Tony Stark in the first three pages, and we've got this kind of the it showed I could do other things.
Yeah.
Is the best thing. And like two other editors, Marvel like messaged me. In fact, I thought there were one editor because I couldn't believe two editors were interested in me. It was one of those kind of like completely failing to understand.
Yeah.
And they offered me like these picture this other idea.
Yeah.
Or like we're interested in a Dazzler story. My first Marvel Universe story was actually an 8-page Dazzler story separate to that.
Yeah.
So like an 8-page story. Then said, okay, we've got this fill-in issue. Do that, and I did that. And then, oh, we got 3-issue mini. Do that. So it's kind of like by not messing up.
Yeah.
That's the best way of putting it.
Keeps going.
I think kind of like I did work that was pleasing to them.
Yeah.
On time and all those kind of stuff, and it basically like playing a Clumulator on a gambling machine, and it got and it got to the point where it's like yeah, JMS quit four, and it's like we need someone to actually take over four quickly in a really horrible position.
Hello,
give it a shot. And I always joke about that when it, I remember being on a comment thread reading people like speculating who would be taking over, and yeah. It's like, I feel sorry for that guy. And then like a couple of days later I get a phone call and like,
so do I.
Yeah. So, no, I am that guy. So yeah, that was, it's the weird thing, is like I got a break and didn't mess it up. It's kind of like, I mean, it's like any form of freelance writing, you know. It's yeah. like you try new writers all the time, and occasionally some people just do one review and it's so bad you never hire them ever
yeah.
again.
Yeah.
And does it come to a point where that relationship changes in a different way, where they say you're like one of our guys now?
Oh, yeah.
And then, I don't know, was it like around Marvel Now or like something like that, where they said, did they offer you and go, what would you like to do?
It's like, there's always dialogue. I mean, I was, when I left RPS, I signed an exclusive with Marvel. That was okay. Exact, I kind of timed at the same time.
Yeah.
So there is those kind of conversations, and then, I mean, what Marvel Now is like, they suggested things to me.
Yeah.
They said, if you've got a different idea, if you've got something you really want to do, talk about that. So yeah, there's the back and forth about, and you know, there's a variety of books I'm doing right now, which come from different places. That's not a really very good answer. That was a kind of fluffy answer.
Yeah.
The answer is, it's complicated.
Yeah.
But it's like, I don't think I've ever pitched Marvel. When I say that, as in like, all those kind of things, they came to me saying, oh, we want to do an Ares mini.
Yeah.
What have you got? So it's that kind of like, I don't often think about other people's characters unless you are paying me.
Okay.
It's a good way of putting it. In that kind of, the things I don't, and that sounds cynical to people.
No.
But it's not, it's like, it's actually a kind of, it's a professional distance, because since you do not own the characters, you have to basically be a professional. So I have to that, I describe it as emotional contraceptives. At the same time, like, you know, I will give everything to any project I do.
Yeah.
But I have to still on some level know it is not quote unquote mine.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
That sounds depressing, but I mean, that's a very, like, and I love doing that, you know, it's, and I love the challenge, I love the idea of someone phoning in me, and it's like, I always say Beach Ray Bill, yeah. You know, the horse face.
Oh, that's one of the early things you did for Marvel.
Yes, and it was like, I mean, what do? You get a phone call, go to a Beach Ray Bill story, so I sat down, looked at where he was in continuity, what he was up to, what were the major unrevealed plot threads, and then I started thinking, what's Beach Ray Bill really about? So you just sort of sit down and sort of think like this. Sort of drumming your fingers. What does this space, this horse space monster mean? I was like, well, you know, he's an alien. That means that's science fiction. You know, that's a fundamentally an atheistic construct. It's an ordered view of the world. It's rationalist.
Yeah.
At the same time, however, he is, you know, he's been given the powers of a god, which is a theistic view of the world. Mm. This is an irrational view of the world. So this is the entire character is about contradiction. And he's also about this utterly ludicrous idea that he's a horse-faced four god. So that the glorious, like, over-the-topness of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
And I start, like, pulling the story together and adding Galactus. It's basically, you know, Beach Ray Bill tries to hunt down and kill Galactus. So this is basically a hunt for God story, but in a very literal...
Literalizing it.
So, you know, that's the way I generally think. As in, it's kind of a critic's way of thinking. It's
trying to work out... what's not been done, what has been done, what the hook is.
What is fundamental.
What's the inroad,
What interests you? Yeah. I mean, I talk about Warren this is the third time I mentioned Warren in an interview, so I probably owe him money. But, you know, it's like one thing I've always loved about his work.
It's the third time, it's like Beetlejuice, he'll appear.
He attacks us with his cane. It's like, it always worked for higher stuff. You can sort of tell he has found something I find interesting here.
Mm.
And it's like, if you're not interested in the concept, it's going to be boring as hell. And it's also, I admire Warren's writing because it's about something. Even if it's kind of like what you might think is like, oh, it's a Beach Ray Bill adventure story. It still has to have some form of meat there. I mean, that's the school I belong to.
Yeah,
there's other writers who are definitely much more, I say a word like popcorn, it sounds like insulting. I don't mean that.
Yeah.
But it's like the only way I can work is in that mode, which is the slightly over serious, I thought about this too much nonsense.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate myself. I'm literally listening to myself here. I hate myself.
I'm interested in seeing, like, so if you have an idea for a story when you're working on, you know, a big name and you want to bring in
what, how much license do you have? Just go, oh yeah, I actually want to bring in another character now.
Like, you talked about continuity as well. Like, how much is, like, what's the process for stuff like that? Because obviously there's more continuity than you can ever, like, reasonably digest in a short period of time. Yeah.
It's true.
It's hard. Like,
you research it, especially current thing. It's like, if you've got an idea, you go to the editors. It's like, I want to use this character, and they say yes or no. You know, the editors will talk to each other. And normally I've researched where somebody is. I mean, the main reason why that Dazzler story I originally wanted to pitch wouldn't have worked is that it was set on the dark side of the moon, where they were based for a while, but they weren't based there anymore.
Right, okay.
And also they were kind of out of play in a different way. So in other words, the Inhumans weren't available for that story, in which case that story cannot be published. And that story is reliant on that bit of continuity.
That's interesting,
you know? So that was the... It might just been crap as well, but it was like, but there was at least that reason I justified to myself why they weren't going to go for it.
Yeah.
So there is that, but some of it is, you can look at continuity and make arguments. Can I use that? And you know, they can. If Marvel think it's a good story, they will twist things to make it work.
Yeah.
And that kind of, like, we can get this to work, if, you know, because we don't do stories about continuity; we do stories about stories.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's probably not a very good answer, but it's kind of it's like basically what you can get away with. Yeah. And I research and I try to at least. I like the idea that all my stories can be picked up by anybody and read. I will tell you anything you need to know in the story. However, stuff that is solely continuity, I won't mention. I will try to put a nod in for people
for people who love that stuff,
for people who know it to basically excuse this. Yeah. And it's kind of like, I mean, it's like Vader. It's like. The first issue is Tatooine, which is, I'm so bad at pronouncing any word, so I can't even pronounce four. My THs are terrible. But it's like, you know, obviously Vader being on the planet is, you know, that's loaded in many ways.
Yeah.
So, but I'm not going to stop and say I cannot go, you know, it's bad for me to return to this planet because of my awful past history here and all the things I connect with it.
Yeah. You just have to...
But, you know, I can do... soft nods in the story without making it explicit. So that's what I try to do. To anybody who cares enough about the continuity, I hope is attentive to realise I'm trying to throw them a bone. You know, but your primary urge has to be to the story you're telling in this moment.
Yeah,
it's especially with the Marvel Universe. It's an exciting hedge, right? You know, this is so many stories are published in the interlink and they form this exciting mesh of things.
Yeah.
And if you actually genuinely try to go through it, it is maddening. And there's some fundamental things you cannot even reconcile, which is kind of... I sort of joke is the... if you think about the only thing you have to believe in the Marvel Universe is the Marvel timeline. You have to simultaneously believe that the Fantastic Four watched the moon landings. At the same time, the Fantastic Four only went on the rocket ship 12 years ago. These two things are not contradictory. You have to believe them once in a kind of like 1984 double think.
Right, okay.
give yourself to it.
Yeah. As in, you have to accept this and that's fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, you hold both those contradictory ideas at the same time. And once you've done that, the rest of it's kind of easy.
Yeah. You touched on Vader a little bit then. Yeah. So, you know, I'm interested in, obviously, that's the big thing that you're working on now. But I think I read somewhere that you almost turned it down. Is that right?
I considered it. It was like, I mean, Jason said yes immediately in that kind of like Star Wars way. And rightly so. I was like, it's a few of it. I was thinking, you know, this is. I wanted to do a villain project for a long time. The idea, there's lots of things about the project I liked, but specifically what held me back was the... I'm trying to get the phrases. The idea that basically we would be doing important scenes.
Right.
As in the idea, this is basically... Okay. The thing that attracted me to Vader in the end was that, you know, it's not just doodling the margins of a story.
Yeah.
Mm. These are fundamentally important scenes for Vader's history. This is canon
in
terms of stuff. You know, we'd never seen Vader's response to understanding that Luke is his son. You know, and those kind of things.
Mm.
And we've never seen... Lots of things in there, specifically the reactions, and it's like I would get to do that.
Okay,
and I would get to the person.
That's a lot of weight to shoulder. Like.
And it was like, the weight doesn't bother me. The question is, would I be best for it?
Okay.
Because you know, Star Wars is something that is fundamentally important. This is like I'm at the age that Empire was the first movie I saw in the cinema.
Yeah.
So in other words, these are formative. As someone who writes Pulp Fiction for a living, these are formative things that lie in the gut of me.
Yeah.
And the thing about Star Wars is I'm the sort of fan where if it's not good, it's not really Star Wars I care about.
Yeah.
And I say that kind of like, it's really, the quality is what matters. It's got to basically up to that scratch. So I was like, And there's other. Is there anybody else who could do this better? Who, you know, writes a Marvel and is in the position to be writing it?
Yeah.
And is there anybody else who, or at least much better? I'm sure. or and is there anyone else? Yeah, that, those kind of questions. And is this something you really want to take because you're taking an opportunity? Mm. And it's not just like I'm going to be writing Iron Man for a bit and then someone else will write Iron Man.
Yeah.
This is very specifically, here's a hole in history. I will be filling that hole.
Yeah.
And that's what made me think about it seriously. And then I sort of went away and I thought, actually, no, yes, that this is, I probably, in terms of like Marvel writers, I like villains more than most of them.
Yeah.
As in, I think my villains are better than my heroes. You know, my most successful books, like my X-Men, you could certainly argue my X-Men run was basically the X-Men as villains. My Journey to Mystery is basically me writing Loki. He's my definitive character, probably, for Marvel. Mm. You know, all those kind of problems. I'm very interested in the question of why people do bad things.
Yeah. Is that something Marvel identified and came to you with, or is it something you kind of knew was happening?
This is what I talk about. I run the dialogues with myself. I'm aware that I'm very interested in bad people. In that kind of like it bugs me because everyone knows what is good. Why would anyone be bad? That's a very simple way of putting it, but that's kind of that is right at the heart of a lot of my better writing, and I say that in quotation marks.
Yeah.
Hate myself again. And I thought, well, no, it's like, you know, yeah, this is, and you've always wanted to do a villain book. I mean, my head, part of me is like, I kind of want to do a Doctor Doom book. It's one of those kind of like, Doctor Doom makes a lot of sense to me.
Hmm.
But the idea of like, no, me doing Vader in this position, in this time, this is really, it's very exciting.
It's so important as well.
Yeah.
Like,
it's kind of, it feels very cool. It's like, and I think it's weird because I thought it would be much harder than it's proving to be. I was expecting, you know, the idea, any time you not working with one set of, you know, working with Marvel is one thing, Marvel and Lucasfilm, you know, the idea that this would be a lot of work, and it's been actually fine. Lucas, they've been incredibly generous. Their actual suggestions are great. You know, when they say no, I get why.
Yeah,
okay. You know, and I've come, all those sort of things, and when I'm writing it, it is delightful, which is a weird thing to say about Darth Vader, as I write it, and I have enormous fun with it, as in,
they're not saying no to you. You're like, no, he doesn't listen to David Bowie. You can't be listening to David Bowie all the time, Kieran.
He's
got a cape. It's much more James Brown kind of like, you know, cape and hottest working man in show business.
James Brown's the Black Panther, so you can't have that.
I'm shocked by how much I enjoy writing it. In that kind of like, I'm not banging my head against the wall or anything. It's like, the tone is freeing. I feel genuinely quite free when being as this awful person. And that's kind of like, both me and Jason, who's obviously writing Star Wars, it kind of our aim is to make it feel like Star Wars, not like a tie-in. The idea of like, you know, the tone has to be, okay, how does, and Jason's job is quite different from mine. Yeah. Jason's trying to make it feel like Star Wars with the Rebel cast.
Yeah.
So in other words,
so Jason's comic, just to fill people in, launched about 3 weeks ago or something like that. Star Wars issue 1.
Yeah.
Marvel got the rights back from Dark Horse. And your Darth Vader is set at the same time as his comic?
Yeah. Well, the idea is they're kind of in exactly the same period. And then sort of,
is it between New Hope and Empire?
We pick up pretty much immediately afterwards. And we're kind of, what I always describe as soft crossover.
Okay.
Because when me and Jason previously wrote Uncanny X-Men and Wolverine and the X-Men at the same time.
Yeah.
And each one had their own very different tones. Like Wolverine and the X-Men was much more playful, and mine was a very big, serious superhero team as Nuclear Deterrent book. But there was enough threads going on between them that made, if you read both, it kind of paid, especially with like also Rick Remender's X-Force at the same time, you could see elements being picked up by books, but if you only read one, you wouldn't notice. That's kind of what we're doing here, in the idea that, you know, I start just after episode 3 of Star Wars. So in other words, Star Wars opens with a raid on a military base, and I pick up on Vader reporting the results of that raid to the Emperor.
How does that actually work at the level of just like your workflow? Do you like just talk about ideas? Do you send him scripts while you're working on them, just so he can like then extrapolate something he can use himself?
Oh yeah, it's we're aware that we create enough space to do our own stories, because basically what Vader's up to, the way I describe it is basically in Jason's book, Vader is the arch villain.
Yeah.
You know, he's Darth Vader. You know, he is this oppressive, enormous black figure who is behind them every step of the way. They can't escape the guy. In my book, that's what he does on Tuesdays. You know, he's a man who is
got a file of facts.
He's got so many other things to do.
And
I am basically the primary thrust of my book is the other things.
Yeah.
Okay.
At the same time, whilst him trying to find time to hunt down Luke. Because yeah. he, you know, quite early in my run, he realises who Luke is and what that means. And right. like, my last 20 years of my life has been a lie. In some way, and that's about as big as it gets.
Yeah, yeah. That's huge. Yeah.
If you think about that, for genuinely digging into the emotions of it, it's really interesting.
Yeah. Even if you take Darth Vader out of that, and that's still horrible.
You know, so I don't, yeah, it's an, oh, oh, you know, the love of my life.
Yeah.
I thought, A, I thought, she, you know, yes, she died, but B, so I, that's further down the line.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
but you can imagine all the kind of responses somebody might have to that.
Yeah.
I have a Vader. And of course, the trick of writing that book is not doing that without reducing Vader.
Of course.
Vader's a move, you know, he's, I don't do like internal narrative captions or anything like that. You are slightly distanced to Vader. Mm. And so you meant to, there's a lot about reading into what he would feel. And we have a supporting cast around him who kind of pick up the weight there. But Vader is, I think I put this in the original pitch document, you should be scared to be in the same room with him. It's never comfortable with Vader. You're aware that if the wrong thing is said, you could just be dead. And that's kind of part of the book for me.
Yeah.
So whilst Jason is doing the kind of the Star Wars mood, I've got to work out a way to make something feel like Star Wars from the evil point of view.
Right.
And there's like the problem with like the thing I had to overcome is that if you just do a straight Empire book, you've got a load of guys with face masks on, so no one can emote. And B, it's all very there's not much Star Wars is about like capital R romance, you know, the glory and the freedom and the people doing enormously cool things and not the fascist jackboot on humanity. So I had to work out ways to, without reducing Darth Vader, add elements that are analogous to a Star Wars. And make
can
it
you talk about the supporting cast? Like this podcast will go out after the comics house.
Actually, the first issue is Vader, it's very much concentrated on Vader.
Yeah.
As in, we, you know, Vader visits Jabba and it sets up the situation. I mean, the situation is, he is one of the sole survivors of the biggest military disaster of all time. And if you, you know, if you rewatch all the Star Wars movies, the Emperor was planning, you know, the Death Star was the plan. We build the Death Star, takes 20 years, and then we can finally get rid of the Senate, which they do at the start of New Hope, and then we can rule the galaxy because we don't need the Senate because we've got this enormous threatening device.
Yeah.
They don't have the enormous threatening device anymore because it blew up. This is really bad for the Empire. Yeah. You know, this is kind of like they can't no longer. So it's the entire. So one of my favorite things is writing the scroll text for the first issue, and I write that the scroll text in the style from the Empire's perspective. It was a time of insurgence. it kind of goes from there. That's there's so much.
That's very cool. That's
fun, but at the same time, doesn't undermine it. I think.
Yeah.
Okay. At the same time, Vader's not solely to blame. He is at least the only person to blame still around.
Yeah.
The idea, you know, he let the rebels escape with the plans deliberately in an attempt to get them find their base. That is completely what he did deliberately.
Yeah.
So if he didn't do that, they would probably sell the Death Star. You know, so he is, his standing has fell in the Emperor's eyes.
Yeah.
And of course, when you get to Empire, you know he's recovered his standing. There's an implied story that Vader ends up, you know what I mean? And at least a lot of my stuff is about, I mean, the metaphor I always use is House of Cards. Yeah. And the idea here is that here's a powerful man who feels slighted, who turns to methods he might not otherwise do to regain his standing. And, you know, obviously Vader's a very different character from Francis. Yeah. But that kind of structure, the idea of Vader trying to do stuff secretly because he no longer can do stuff openly.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's a lot of the things that drive a book. Supporting cast. I wouldn't say the inspiration for this, but one of the inspiring things was watching in Empire, you know, when he's briefing the bounty hunters.
Mm. Yeah.
Two things there. Micromanaging. Yeah. Shouldn't do that. He's got bigger problems. He knows them all.
Yeah.
You know, there's specifically when you, it's like when you're commissioning a freelancer, you say, don't be late with this one. You really can't be late with this one.
Yeah.
That's exactly the same Boba Fett, no disintegrations. There is a familiarity there.
Yeah.
The idea, he has moved in bounty hunter circles before.
Yeah. Right.
So that kind of gives you, says you a bit about where we build up the supporting cast. The idea of like, in the underworld, there's a lot of crossing over there and those kind of characters.
Yeah.
I mean, Boba Fett turns up in the first issue, as everyone have seen.
Yeah.
But there's people I invent, there's people who are new, but they're kind of the darker side. And that allows you to, more shadowy side, that kind of roguish area.
Yeah.
So that allows me to build up characters with very different personality types from just the stormtrooper.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that you can do stuff outside the fascist organisation. And to be honest, that feels more Star Wars. You need a Han Solo. And my Han Solo, the character who kind of fits the Han Solo archetype, introduced in issue 3, who is a character called Aphra.
Okay.
Who is, we said this in the list, she's kind of like ethically inverted Indiana Jones would be a good way of putting it.
Amazing.
She's someone who finds old artifacts and weapons and puts them in the wrong hands.
Okay.
Because, you know, it should be in an armory.
Yeah.
That kind of way. So that's kind of, and there's fun in it, but she's both fun and playful, also really messed up.
Right, okay.
So that's kind of tonally, it's like a very, it's a very, my book's come off in a dark mirror to a Star Wars itself, is a good way of putting it.
How much of it is, I mean, I was just interested in when you were talking about, oh yeah, you know, it's Vader's fault that they, you know, got out there with the plans. It almost sounds like this is pub chat that I've been having since I was like 18, 19 years old, with people going, ah, well, actually, like, how much of that do you, you know, as being a Star Wars fan, do you bring into your actually writing?
My most extreme fan theories have entirely been thrown out because we can't do that. they're literally cheating.
We actually had Gary Witter on the podcast last week, and he was saying there's a couple of people at Lucas who they're like, you know, they know every single thing. They're like oracles. Did you have access to them? Could you go to them with your ideas and be like,
what was the thing they had once?
The story
Holocron.
Oh, no,
like the centralised continuity thing. Mm. I went to a talk about it at Star Wars Celebration.
Really? Okay.
The story group are pretty much those people, as in they're kind of like. So it's interesting that
they're like, ha ha ha.
No.
No, I don't do anything deconstructionary. Is the best way of putting it. As in, like, I mean, if you get me in the pub, I do a kind of joke reading that, you know, Obi-Wan knows everything. Obi-Wan actually killed Luke's family to make them go with him.
Right.
Because, you know, he immediately, before Luke tells them the family is dead, Obi-Wan actually comforts him. And it says that, you know, Vita definitely, you know, and he also killed all the Jawas in that kind of like, you know, oh yeah, Vita definitely Imperial marksman who did this. You know, and it's like, obviously I'm joking for that, but you know, if you want to do an extreme reading,
of course,
but you wouldn't do that in any series. But they're kind of, you know, Vader completely, you know, Vader explicitly said, we're taking a big risk here, Vader. They will lead us straight. And then you get Leia going no, they let us go. You know, so this isn't even like a conspiracy. This is very explicitly the story that people tend to like. They tend to forget that bit, I think.
Yeah.
Where was I? So that the building off that struck me as very, because it's a big mistake. You know, Vader isn't going to shirk that off. Vader will take responsibility because he's that guy.
Hold his hands up in the pub, guys. On Friday night, I'm really sorry. I messed up here.
It's on me.
Writing a Vader and the Emperor together is fun because it's kind of when you start thinking about the power struggle between the two, especially when Vader realizes that he has been lied to. There's an implied the power differential there and what they are not talking about. And any scene, this is secret drama, is what they're not talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, for me, the secret drama is what saying is minor. What they're not actually genuinely expressing is where things are interesting.
Yeah.
And so any scene I've written with those two in, really, really fun.
Yeah.
So that kind of, and the plot elements that kind of come into play. I mean, basically, in the first episode, Vader becomes aware of two things. A, he's aware that something's going up with this Luke kid.
Yeah.
Not that he knows who Luke is, but the name. But he knows he's not an idiot. As in, you get a series of flashbacks and he kind of pieces these information together. As in, he had a light... We will see in Drayton's book, he had a lightsaber.
Yeah.
He had he knew Obi-Wan.
Some training.
This guy was strong with the Force.
Yeah.
And that kind of... Tony, it's really fun sitting down writing, the Force is strong with this one. Even in a flashback, and I get paid for that.
Yeah.
Brilliant job.
Well, we've got a weekly Star Wars show called Rebel Base, and we took the first issue and we sort of tore it apart. Not tore it apart in a bad way, but sort of went through it quite sort of methodically. Like, and a lot of the things we were saying is, some of the references maybe felt a bit heavy-handed, whereas, you know, there's a bit where he says these aren't the slaves you're looking for, and he goes well, that was worth a try. And we were like, okay, for me that feels slightly heavy-handed. Like, how hard is it for you when you're writing to sit down and go, you need to hit the references, you need to hit the, you know, the fanboys up, but, you know,
I think it's a really hard line. It's a really hard line to walk. There's definitely some bits of like, I wrote and then I cut.
Yeah.
Oh, I wrote then handed in and then we cut.
Yeah.
In that when I
you wrote laughed then we're like, no, we can't do that.
The more jokey it gets, the more
exactly. Yeah.
There's a couple of Aphra specifically. The fact she's a bit more playful means there's a few lines she said to Vader in issue 3 when she met him.
Yeah.
were referencey, and I was like, no, this is too much. Yeah. I'm very glad we lost them. Yeah. But there's other soft. I mean, there's a bit. What do you feel about issue one? Where I've got a good feeling about this. I thought that was good. I like that.
That was one of the ones actually we thought
we liked that.
I thought that was a really good one
because I feel like it's something people would say.
Yeah,
like I think it's very hard because you have to realize it depends how strict you want to be with the logic of it, and the characters within the situation would have no knowledge
exactly
of any
that's
of
what
this
we're
stuff.
Talking about, yeah.
So if they hark on it or channel it, it's kind of strange and reality breaking.
Yeah,
it's really
difficult because
it's an illusion, because it's kind of like the opening scene of Vader. I don't mean in a bad way, but the illusion as in how much people are willing to go with it.
Yeah,
but and there's a couple of bits where I'm writing Vader very straight.
Yeah,
it's about there's very little of my I'm quite a meta writer. I generally talk about the fiction I'm writing a lot, and I'm not doing because that's not Star Wars.
Yeah,
but like the opening is Vader heading into Jabba's palace, and he walks, and it's basically a kind of shot-for-shot reconstruction of Luke's.
Yeah, and those pages are in Star Wars.
They are,
And that is walking line there. But the point is, I'm trying to. It's not really a joke. It's about drawing a difference. These are two characters who are similar.
Yeah.
You know, these are two.
Yeah, I think it is, because this is what Luke. What will eventually happen? Yeah.
This is what Luke will. But in fact, we know what Luke does in that situation. What Vader does in a similar situation and different tells you how Vader is different to Luke.
Yeah.
And all the way through that. Yeah. I mean, there's one of my. All the way through that. That's kind of how it works for me.
Yeah.
And that's the point of that. As in, basically. Luke is the lead of Star Wars. Vader's the lead of my book.
Yeah.
So drawing the dark mirror. I said that earlier, but that's kind of how I'm thinking of this.
Yeah.
And Vader turns up and he acts very differently towards Jabba than Luke does. You know, it's even stuff like the pit. You know, as in there's a bit. He actually steps. He's standing on the pit and he just steps back.
Yeah,
he looks down and then he takes one step back and they exchange glance. You know, and that's because Vader. You know, Vader's better in the Force than Luke is at this point.
Exactly. Yeah,
and that's kind of whilst they are clearly dancing with the text.
Yeah,
that I would hope they are not too much for people.
Yeah.
Though, to be honest, that's it's only
so hard.
Trying to difference between showing something new and something there's elements of like there's part of the fanboyness of it.
Yeah,
you kind of want to see stuff you know. At the same time, you want to be make up new stuff that feels like Star Wars.
Yeah.
Is the way I would put it. And that's a lot of my idea. I've thrown a load of ideas out which I thought were interesting, but not Star Wars. And like especially with the villains, as in a lot of Vegas antagonists are new characters.
Yeah.
So I'm trying how what can I do that's new in Star Wars? That's the big challenge. And a lot of them are fun. As in when I sat, I sat down and I watched all the movies I had in my notepad.
Yeah.
And we watched it very intensely, me and my wife. And pages of scribble. This is like if we ever do a big collection, these scribble at the back, I suspect we should include.
That's amazing homework.
Was that part of the pitch process?
I can't remember which order I did it. I think I actually did this. This is after it was kind of like, let's do it that way. As in, it was me looking for meat.
Yeah.
As in, I kind of had I didn't need the close reading wasn't required because the basic pitch is. Vader running Vader builds his own power source inside the Empire, trying to reclaim his status as he has fell after the events of Star Wars. That's kind of stuff I could do off my knowledge of Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah. As part of that process, did you watch the prequels? Because obviously,
you
would have grown up with like one particular embodiment of Vader, and then obviously later in your life, you would have got this additional information about who this person is, more knowledge, more kind of things to draw upon. How much did that stuff factor in?
Intensely. I mean, this is all kind of the fact that the current situation due to the extended universe and the compressing and the current situation, the canon is controllable. The canon is the six movies, Rebels, Clone Wars, or comics, and the two books.
Yeah.
Unless I'm missing anything, that's I can consume that. As opposed to Marvel, when there's no way
you have
can
some mastery of.
Yeah.
I can actually have a close reading of the canon that's available. Especially the movies, which are the thing most people be aware of.
Mm.
So, in terms of Vader's emotional journey, and I think you need to kind of Vader's realization that he has a children. You need to use the prequels by definition.
Course, yeah.
that's kind of like that, and that's why it matters to Vader.
Yeah.
And that's why it's such an enormous, everything changes moment for him.
Yeah.
I lean on it all pretty much equally in terms of like thinking about Vader's interiority. In terms of what he's thinking.
Yeah. As someone who's working on their Star Wars content, when the Force Awakens trailer obviously came out, like, what did you think? Because that does a really fine line of just brand new stuff, but then ends with a Falcon.
Yeah, it's this intrigue, because it's like, you know, you want Star Wars, but it's kind of like, you want Star Wars, but, you know, here is new stuff, here is kind of how the two mashing.
Yeah.
And, like, that's what I genuinely hope the Jabba's Palace stuff is. You know, Jabba invading the room, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and it leads to different places, and we start doing new stuff, and there's that kind of element. I think as Marvel, the one thing with the story group is very interesting, and that, especially the further I go on, the more I kind of like, I want to use a crime organisation here.
Yeah.
I can completely make one up. Is there anything you would suggest?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's kind of quite cool.
That's cool.
Yeah. And that's like, and I've been, in other words, if you're writing a genre plot,
yeah,
if there's something else, because this, the continuity is so small, I mean, small in the relative sense of the Marvel universe.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
As in, like, 50 years, you know, if you're connectivity in an interesting way, that's a pretty cool opportunity. I want to lean into it. At the same time, there's some of the ideas, I'm very happy when I get a little note from like the story group, right? I love this.
Yeah.
That makes me quite happy.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's very cool.
Yeah.
I'd like to move then. So let's talk about, we touched upon it a little tiny bit earlier, but like music and comics. So Foreign Gram, you know, huge musical comic. Wicked and Divine, I'm a huge, huge fan of. The music runs through that entire thing. How do you write and make a comic that's essentially about music?
I tell you, it's one of these weird things. Of course, comics and music are kind of literally opposite.
Yeah.
In that with music, with comics, you have control of your visuals, and you have no sound, and you don't have any control of timing. You can't control how people will read your book. With music, it's literally the opposite. You have no visuals, you only have sound, and you have perfect control of timing. As in, you can present people in information, or like, these are literally opposite.
Yeah.
So it's impossible to do a one-for-one translation. And that's kind of where we started. Yeah. And that's kind of the appeal of it. The idea of trying to do something actually easily achievable, it strikes me as desperate under-ambition. It's like, and there's a sort of magic when you fail to achieve something.
Yeah.
And you kind of have originality by default. As in, okay, here's an impossible problem. How can we try to even capture a slightless bit of it?
Yeah.
Okay, that'll work. So that's kind of what we do. So me and Jamie spend a lot of time thinking about different techniques.
Yeah.
And the actual initial victims going to bed to that night, which is basically our rave issue. And the entire issue is about a lot of drug stuff going on it.
Yeah.
There's a lot about like ketamine-esque time dilation. We have like sensory blur, and we have lots of colour and like visual effects. And we have a sense of momentum and how the...
That's cool.
Yeah, and it's like across an entire issue. And we kind of did something similar before in issue 7 of... the singles club, the second Phonogram volume, which is basically structured around the song Wolf Like Me by TV on the Radio.
Okay.
And it was basically how the panelling worked, created a beat, and it went intro, verse, chorus, bridge, breakdown, repeated chorus to end.
Yeah.
And what we did with the visuals and the story, we tried to create a narrative structure that basically mirrored the thing and the song. So we're trying to basically get that sense of fluid momentum.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we're doing here. So that's like one way we did it. And so it depends how much you want to lean it. And sometimes it's just... Okay, very extreme examples. That's when we really push it.
Yeah.
And occasionally more, it's just more like dudes talking shit in the pub. It's more like the conversations you would have around culture.
Okay. Because,
you know, we use music more. And I think... You know, somebody... I wrote about games, so many... I think the reason I do music more in my comics...
Yeah.
...is because I had an outlet to get all the games out. So I did games writing. You know, I did music writing for various places, but... Yeah. Never as much. So this kind of these ideas sort of sat in my head like a weird sort of pus boil, and eventually exploded at the top. Whilst games got to be slowly drained.
Yeah.
Basically, I just think it's interesting, and the idea of actually, it's kind of what criticism is anyway. Criticism will ever really capture what the art does, but you try to translate the feeling into the words or you know what you're talking.
Yeah.
And get something from that. Some of my favourite reviews, literally, I synesthetically get what the medium is.
Yeah.
That, I guess. The fact it's impossible is at least part of the challenge and the interest.
Okay, cool. But, I mean, it's such a big part of the issues as well, but when I asked you about it just over email, I said, you know, there's a couple of songs. You sent me a playlist that was like 250 songs.
I think it's 216 now.
But every single one that I listened to, I could think... And I was quite new to Wicked and Vine, but every single song that I listened to, I was like, I can hear the comic in this song. And that is a really odd thing for me to sort of put those two together.
Thank you. I mean, it's like, it's weird, because I've started doing playlists for quite a long time, and Spotify makes making playlists public easier. I've done it more. I mean, Young Avengers was big. That was like 110. And Wicked and Divine is it's like a 30 to 60 issue series. So I swear, by the time the end of it, it'll be every song I've ever liked. But that kind of the mood of it was very important. Especially because like last year was very intense for me personally. So yeah, there was a lot of like songs as shorthand for emotions or states or thinking or ideas. I mean, like, especially with Wicked and Divine is, that's a great noise.
Sounds like a big fart. It won't pick up that much.
Oh, that's a shame. A big fart. Right, you say something really meaningful.
It's like, and the mood of it, we can actually do a comic that's, we're going to make a big pop record. I mean, this is one of my favourite reviews. A critic called Doug Walt did. It's like, Lennon and McCartney sat down to quote unquote write a swimming pool when they did Imagine. The idea that, okay, we're going to do a really big pop record.
Yeah.
And Wick Div is also, okay, this is everything we do, but we're going to do this on the larger scale. We're not going to be like self-defeating narrative. We're going to actually, we actually think this is going to be enormous. We're going to love it.
Yeah.
And we throw everything we've ever loved about pop culture, not just pop music, everything. So this is, you know, from the Warhammer to the games to the club stuff to all the movies we've ever loved into one package. This is kind of, as a guy who is, you know, I'm 39, about to be 40, this is kind of like the entire story of everything I've loved and defined myself as a creator and a writer and a human being.
It's a big
one. Absolutely. It's just kind of like, it's the funny thing is, this is like 10 years on from Phonogram. Like, the first Phonogram was very clearly about me turning 30. Like, it was actually me dealing with a lot of those kind of stuff. And this is very clearly about me being 40. Okay. It's like, you know, that was, I'm afraid of being 30 and old. And it's about being afraid of being 40 and dead.
Yeah.
In a very real way. It's, oh my God, I'm almost going to die.
Yeah.
Brilliant. what genuinely is life for? Why be an artist anyway? That's kind of what Wick Div is beneath the surface.
Yeah.
So, the songs are used to ways to think about. So there's bits of weirdness. There's a lot of like, these are really big pop records.
Yeah.
That's kind of part of it. As in the idea that the tone is euphoric and sad and weird and like, and it's not, when you start putting me in the list, you remember how many pop records are about people dying.
Yeah.
How many pop records are about people dying young. I mean, the idea of Wick and Divine being, if those who are listening don't know, it's basically every 90 years, gods are reincarnated on Earth, who are loved and amazed and hated for like 2 years, and then they die. So this is basically a device to concentrate the concept of mortality, because it doesn't mean if we're alive for 2 years or 10 years or 70 years, that's still a very finite time versus the eternity.
Yes.
Yeah, so why do anything? So that's kind of what the book's about. So it go, anytime you start talking about what Wicked's about, it goes pretty dark.
I like that about it, and I think the point of, you know, I think it's quite an unforgiving book as well. Like, I don't think it eases you in at any point.
Oh no,
it drops you right into it.
Like, and it sort of doesn't even assume like that you have any knowledge, because there's no way you can have the knowledge from. Was that a thing that you guys thought, no, we're going to write this thing, we're going to make this thing, and people have to go with it?
I thought, the funny thing is, me and Jamie swore we thought we were being accessible. Yeah. We thought, we're going to try this time. We're not going to be like Phonogram. We're not going to be like Phonogram. We're going to actually try to eat. No. Yeah. I think we must have higher standards, not higher standards, higher tolerances.
Yeah.
That kind of nonsense.
I love you calling it nonsense.
Yeah, no, it's like, I'm aware that I find it interesting. I pull stuff apart, and in terms of, I try to like, there's probably definitely bits we've misstepped, I guess. But we do quite like respecting an audience's intelligence, which is kind of all these, which I find, I don't like saying that because it sounds like insulting to anybody who doesn't get it.
Yeah.
But we're aware that this is kind of the pace we would accept our stories at. Roll with us, we'll kind of get to everything in the end.
Yeah.
And, you know, we won't leave you in the dark unnecessarily.
Yeah.
If you don't need to know it, we won't tell you it.
Yeah.
So if you don't know something, relax. It's fine.
We'll get there. Yeah.
You'll pick this up in time.
Yeah.
That's kind of at least part of the attitude. It's weird because the issue of, like, issue 9 is kind of the interview with Anank, who is kind of the elder figure in the pantheon. And we finally get some straight answers. So it's going to be quite nice for people, I think.
Who does the interview? Is it because there's a critic character?
Well, you can guess.
It's there from the beginning.
I can't say who does the interview. Yeah,
okay, right.
But
yeah.
I think I think if anyone who guessed who would do the interview, they would probably be right.
Okay, right. That's good.
How much is, like, but, obviously,
They are fun characters to write. They're amazing. Yeah. I'm just going to give it away. Yes, it's Cassandra. Cassandra is the very cynical character who doesn't believe anything. Yeah. Those two characters. The head is actually really good, as in, because it's quite issue. Right, I said it's the big rave scene, so it's a lot of flesh, and very sensual. That's a word. I mean, saying the word sensual sounds horrible. this is like quite dry. It's almost like a one act play.
Yeah.
In this kind of like these characters in a very intense space.
Yeah. I think the reason I like Cassandra is because when you first meet, you just think, oh god, I've seen this character so many times, but then the more it goes on and you go, ah, actually there's so much more to that character actually that we're not seeing, because she actually genuinely cares.
It's true. I mean, I try, all the characters are complicated. It's like Baal. I think Cassandra is almost like, she's the flip of Laura.
Okay.
You know, she's kind of like, you know, Laura's this ultimate fangirl. And
Cassandra
isn't the opposite, and they are...
But they work together so well.
They are tied together, and then that's kind of like, that was very explicit. And Cassandra is a really good, allows me to auto-critique the book.
Yeah.
Pretty much anything I say, anything Cassandra says, I think's right. Yeah. And so, you know, she's Cassandra, no one listens to her.
Yeah.
This is iffy.
There's precedent.
Exactly. It's like, she should have chosen a different name. That's definitely the thing. But it's like Baal, you know, Baal is, you know, very aggressive and very egotistical, and he's like a character who's, at the same time, I think by this point, anyone who's been following the issues realise he's probably one of the more moral characters.
Yeah.
Yes, he's abrasive, and yes, he frankly is very arrogant, but there is a sense of worry for people, and also the willing to sacrifice his own, you know, his own things to other people that kind of is running in through there. He's just, you know, that kind of, because people are complicated. We aren't that simple.
Yeah.
You know, even people who I hope we're more complicated anyway.
So it's a theme tune for our episode, but Summer Camp's Pink Summer is you said it's a theme tune for your book. Why is that?
It was like November. Our favourite con in the UK is Thought Bubble in Leeds, which is astounding. We'd loved it. We've been to every one. We were invited to it on the first. That was our kind of the first con anyone invited us to.
Yeah.
So it's grown enormously. So it started out with like a few hundred people, and now it's like 10,000-12,000. So it's a medium-sized UK con. But they let us DJ, and it's the DJ, and the DJ party has grown every year, and it's almost like our Christmas.
Yeah.
It's like, and this year was in the town hall. Enormous place, dance floor, people throwing shapes till 4 in the morning again. This is weird and like bacchanalian. So I love it all. But specifically, that year, Summer Camp, who we know and are friends with, were playing at just a venue there, so we went there. And I just had a moment, I listened to actually Lips to Pink Summer. This is pretty much the...
It's fantastic,
It's brilliant, but B, it's kind of pretty much what the book's about.
Yeah.
And it's like, and the idea of like somebody in a quite similar position to me and Jamie as in, you know, a duo.
Yeah.
We're talking about the concept of love and need and death. This may kill us, what a way to die.
Yeah.
That kind of like back and forth antipathy to it all.
Yeah.
That was something really appealing, and I sort of like halfway through the gig I sort of, it clicks, and I ran outside and just like made sure I made a note to upload it to the playlist.
Yeah.
And we did a launch party for the book when it came out, and we booked out. It's quite funny because, like, you know, we have this, they don't do launch parties, it's not video games.
Yeah.
So we're going to do a proper launch party. We're going to book out a venue. We're going to book a band.
Amazing.
Have like, it'll be great. And so Summer Camp, we paid them, they came and played. So basically, they're very much in my head tied to the whole endeavour. And it's a great song.
It is a great song, yeah. I just watched Beyond Clueless in the summer, and they do the soundtrack for that. So, and I went to see the film shown at a festival, and Summer Camp performed the score live. It was so good. You should definitely do that with the next book. Get them to come and cool.
Actually, we talked to Summer Camp about collaborating quite a bit.
Yeah.
As in, we're very, both very busy.
Yeah.
So there's something we're definitely doing shortly together. There's a larger project we've talked about a few times.
Oh, wow, excellent, yeah.
And it'll be very cool to do if we can find a chance.
Definitely.
Like, if we find a spare month, we could do it.
Must be hard when you have to write all these Star Wars comics.
It's hard life.
Okay, we're just going to go to some... had some feedback then. We'll just go to some of these. We had a tweet from Duke of Havoc. He said, Dear Kieran, what's the split of workload between writing comics and coming up with puns for Twitter?
I'm assuming you know this guy.
Yeah, he's a gentleman. He runs a website. I'm not going to plug it because you're being mean to me. but growing up, puns is entirely pleasurable. That's kind of something I do to avoid work.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's about 90% of my workload. Yeah. And 10% of my workload is actually work.
Okay. So the next one's from John Hood. He says, "Which is your favourite Star Wars movie and why?"
Empire, because I'm a bit of a goth. The Empire, I'm not Vader, therefore the Empire striking back is a good thing for me.
Yeah.
It is really his Empire. It's this kind of like, I find it, the actual structure is fascinating. I find the fact it's the unresolved nature of it, the fact how it sort of floats in space, no pun intended. The weird sort of gleeful dark romance of it all. And of course there is, as I said earlier, this is the first movie I ever saw in a cinema. This is formative. This is origin story stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Empire.
Cool. I'm just going to go on a bit of an indulgent digression here.
Go for it.
My girlfriend's father coined the word goth in relation to music.
Really?
Yeah, he used to write sounds. He was called Steve Keaton. That's the pen name he used to write under, Steve May. He coined the word goth in relation to music when he was reviewing this band. And we went to the British Library recently. They had this big goth exhibit. And we didn't know it was there. We got onto the last part of the exhibit. There's a Clive Barker stuff. Went around the corner. It's like how goth had been appropriated by subcultures. And there was this huge placard of her father's article. And she was like, "No way!" And we spoke to the British Library, and she managed to get this from the British Library. He's got it in his office now.
That's amazing.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
No, I went to that. It was amazing. Yeah. It's like, you know, I loved it enormously. It's, there's been a big. I mean, I'm wearing an Alexander McQueen jacket here, so I'm very much in the kind of school mode last year.
Yeah. So when she went to the British Library to collect this exhibit, she contacted them and said, "Oh, my dad wrote this. Can I please have it for his office?" And the woman from the British Library came down and gave it to her. He's like, "Yeah, I thought I'd recognise you. I thought I'd basically just look for the most gothic person in the lobby."
So last year at the British Library, we had a comics exhibit, goth exhibit. Yeah. It's like, was I curating that year? It's like, it generally could not be more me if it was horrific.
Yeah. And finally then from Carl Barrett, who asked, if you were to create a comic based around another Star Wars character, who would it be and why?
Oh wow. I want to go with joke hands. I would just probably Bobber. That's an easy answer. Let's go a bit weirder. I just do the bands. You know, the idea of basically doing phonogram, you know, the entire
thing. That's such a good idea, yeah.
You can do it, it'll be good.
That'd be good. So Vader should be is already out now by the time you listen to this.
It should be.
So that's good.
Put it live at the right time.
The fact it's, you know, it's out there, making it's been enormous. So I really can't wait to see what people make of it.
Yeah. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast I'm sure we'll see you again very, very soon. And thank you very much for listening.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am extremely excited to invite you to Rachel Uncensored. It's my podcast where I sit down and get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. And sometimes we might be under the influence when we do so. We cover things from personal stories to hot button issues. And it's the only place on the internet you can find an uncensored version of me. It's a side of me that you might not have seen before because it's not the most family or brand friendly. But don't worry, I'm still sort of slightly a decent human being. If you're intrigued, then make sure you check it out. New episodes drop every Wednesday. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.